podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to this week's Attacking Scrum podcast. Thanks for downloading. We've got some European rugby to look forward to next week, and delighted to say that I was joined by Steph Thomas to do that. Obviously, you'll have heard Steph on the podcast before, top journalist and good friend of the show. Of course, we previewed Dragons versus Bristol and, of course, the Scarlets away at Toulon. So all of that coming up. But we also looked at the other big news story of the week, which was the launching of the Autumn Nations Cup, as it's set to be called, and the decision that the broadcast rights are going to be on Amazon Prime. So a move away from free-to-air rugby for the Welsh national side, which, as you can imagine, has created quite a lot of news this week. So we have a look at that, but also what the long-term solutions are for world rugby and international rugby and how that might affect the region. So I had a really good chat with Steph about some of those permutations, and I think particularly what the autumn should look like in the long term. And really, really good to chat to him and really interesting stuff. So all of that, as well as the preview of the European quarterfinals coming up. As always, a big thanks to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. I've been particularly reliant on this stuff over the weekend as I've been trying to decorate our house and spend every working hour and spare hour over there. So a big thanks to them on and off the pitch.
Shane Williams, the lead ball, Jamie Roberts against Drew Mitchell. Roberts, Mitchell gets back to make the tackle. Wales still in possession. Created by Shane Williams in midfield. Must be Lee Byrne. Williams. Shane Williams started it and finishes it.
Welcome to another episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. Plenty to get through this week, and we've got some European Cup quarterfinals to look forward to, albeit the Challenge Cup rather than the Heineken Cup. But nonetheless, some exciting stuff there. We also have the big news story of the week with Wales' autumn games going behind the paywall on Amazon Prime. So we'll be looking at all of these things, and I'm delighted to say that joining me to do that is Stefan Thomas. How are you, Steph?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yes, not too bad, thanks. Last time we spoke was, I guess, just ahead of the Welsh derbies. And I remember we were saying at the time, as good as it was to have rugby back, it felt like a bit of a phony war, and it was hard to get excited. What do you feel with regards to these European quarters? Presumably a bit more on the line. Do these kind of get you a bit more excited?
Yeah, a lot more excited. Obviously, from a Welsh perspective, you've got the Dragons going to Bristol, and the Scarlets travel to Toulon in the European Challenge Cup quarterfinals. You know, as we said prior to the regional derbies, the Scarlets had a mathematical chance, but realistically, they were glorified pre-season games. But you know, this is cup rugby now. You know, you lose, you're out. So really looking forward to them. And in terms of the main Champions Cup, I think there's some cracking games there as well. You know, the quality would be really high. It's the closest you can get to Test rugby. So, yeah, I'm really excited.
Before we get onto the Welsh regions, which of those Heineken Cup quarterfinals are you most looking forward to?
For me personally, I mean, there's a lot of really, really good games, but I think the Leinster Saracens one is the one that really stands out, doesn't it? I mean, Saracens have, they've had a rough season, to put it mildly. And obviously, you know, they're a competitive, you know, they've got a really strong culture, Saracens. And obviously, they say the right things in the press before Premiership games. But the realistic aspect of it is that they've been relegated and they've been effectively playing dead rubbers for the past 4 or 5 months. And I think they would have, the talk in camp would have been, everything would have been centred on this Champions Cup quarterfinal in Dublin. It's effectively, you know, England against Ireland. It's, you know, Leinster are the form side in the Northern Hemisphere, haven't lost a game this season. Obviously won the Pro 14 this week, and Saracens, obviously they've had a write-off of a season, but we know the Saracens at their best can beat Leinster, as they showed in last season's final. Farrell being out as a you know, it's a huge, huge setback for them. But I think this is going to be a test match and everything but names. So that's the game that stands out. But they're all going to be quality contests, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That is the one that you can just see the level of intensity getting stepped up, because like you say, it's been a write-off of the season for Saracens. We've criticised, and I know I certainly have, the intensity of the Pro 14 throughout its existence, really. But actually, the Premiership has been the same, really, since lockdown came back, because as well as having Saracens relegated, you've also got sides having to play in two games every week. So it does give you a lot of dead rubbers into the mix, which, you know, we're perhaps not used to seeing with English rugby. But yeah, when it comes to this one, you're right. It's going to feel pretty close to a test match. Just before we get onto the Welsh sides, though, I did want to pick your brains. You mentioned Owen Farrell. Obviously, there's been a huge amount of coverage with regards to not only the tackle last week, but also the penalties that he's incurred with his suspension. Just wanted to get your take on that first and foremost.
Well, what can you say? There has been out there. I mean, it was an extremely dangerous tackle, wasn't it? It was high. Letter of the law, red card. I just think, you know, he's been criticised for his tackle technique for a very long time. And if truth be told, he's been very lucky not to receive more red cards in his career. So I don't think it should be a shock to anyone. Personally, I think the amount of time he's been banned for is quite lenient. I think it could have been a lot longer. I think it's an absolute farce that Eddie Jones, his national coach, is allowed to almost intervene in the disciplinary process. I think I think it's a massive conflict of interest. I'm sure most people would agree with that. So, look, I just think, you know, he's a great player. He's a great competitor. You know, he's not a dirty player, but that was a reckless challenge. It was stupid, and he deserves everything he gets. Hopefully, it will mean that he'll sort of amend the way he tackles, and he'll think long and hard about it in the future. But yeah, I mean, fully agree with the suspension, and you know, as I said, I think it should have been a lot stricter.
Yeah, fair enough. Right, let's jump into the two quarterfinals featuring the Welsh sides. We're going to start with Dragons versus Bristol. I suppose certainly on paper, Bristol were going to this heavy favourites, but I just wanted to touch on home advantage to start with. From what you've seen in the game since lockdown, has home advantage been negated a bit by the lack of crowds, or have you still seen that playing at home still gives you a significant advantage?
No, I think it has been negated. I mean, I think you'd still prefer to play at home than travel, wouldn't you? But, you know, you look at a lot of the results in the Gallagher Premiership especially, they've been sort of all over the place, haven't they, in terms of away wins and the like. And, you know, Dragons have only got to go about 45 minutes up the road. So, you know, there's going to be no crowd. So I don't think, you know, the venue of the game is going to really have any impact on the result, really. The main impact on the result will be the fact that the Dragons aren't the strongest in the front five. And that's where Bristol are significantly stronger, and that's where they likely win the game. But in terms of the game being played at Ashton Gate, given the fact there's no crowd, I don't think that's going to have any impact on the result.
And talking about, you know, kind of team selection and things like that, Bristol were in action today. They lost to Wasps, but with a heavily changed side. You would imagine that is in preparation for the game. I mean, to be fair, English sides are having to rotate quite a bit anyway, but with the a European quarterfinal looming, albeit in the second tier, you know, both sides are going to be going into this fully loaded team selection wise, you'd expect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you touched on it there. You know, the English sides have absolutely no choice but to rotate their teams because of the crazy scheduling with the midweek fixtures. And you know, Pat Lam, I think, has been quite vocal about the fact that they are targeting silver this season, and that the Challenge Cup is a priority for them. That the weakness with the Challenge Cup, of course, is that a lot of teams don't prioritise it, but Bristol are. You know, the Dragons are obviously in a stronger proposition than they would have been if the pandemic hadn't hit. You know, they've recruited well. you know, we all know about Nick Tompkins. He's brought, he was impressive in the Welsh derbies. You know, Jonah Holmes will hopefully be available as well. Greg Bateman adds a bit of grunt up front, but on the whole, I think, you know, you look at the Dragons pack, they've got an outstanding back row. Their back line is greatly improved, especially with Tompkins, as I said, but the front five, you know, they lost Corey Hill. You know, Bateman's a good club player, but he's not like a top end international player. So I think, you know, if you looked at the way the Dragons played against the Scarlets, I know they had a very weak in front row, but they played some really good rugby. But they were just absolutely taken to the cleaners in the front five. Leon Brown obviously improved things. Elliot D as well. But I just think that is an area where Bristol are significantly stronger than them, and I do expect Bristol to win the game fairly comfortably.
If you're Dean Ryan going into this fixture, any areas of weakness in the Bristol side or any areas that you think the Dragons will be able to exploit?
I think sometimes, you know, you look at Bristol, they play quite a lot of rugby in terms of they like to put it through the hands. So they got a strong pack on forwards and they can play the percentages, but a lot of rugby is really high risk. So I think obviously Sam Davis will be key for the Dragons. But when Sam, if anything happened to Sam Davis, they'd be in serious trouble. Their chances of winning games would just plummet, to be honest. He's been a real key signing for them because, yeah, he can play to the game line. You know, he's a very creative player, but his game management is second to none. Excellent goal kicker as well. So he's going to be key for them. And I think, you know, it's just playing smart rugby, really. But you just look at Bristol, right? You just look across their team. You know, we know some people would argue Sammy Randradra is the best player in the world at the moment, certainly in the top three or four anyway. You know, they've got some brilliant backs, as I said. They've got one of the best coaches in the world. But they are significantly stronger than the Dragons in the front five. And I just don't think the Dragons have the personnel to really compete with them in that area. I think their back, if they have any chance of winning, their back row has got to really do a job. That's one area where they can match, if not better, Bristol. But there's too much of a gulf between both tight fives, in my opinion. So I'm not saying it's going to be one-sided, but I'm struggling to see them causing an upset.
And you mentioned that, obviously, we kind of look back at the Welsh derbies there, and you touched on the Dragons versus Scarlets. Have you seen anything from, I mean, again, Dragons have chopped and changed their lineup somewhat during those games. Have you seen anything within there that, you know, is signs of encouragement?
Yeah, definitely. I think in the, they were the better team against the Ospreys. They should have won that game. They had the most of territory, the better of territory and possession. Obviously, they had a man advantage most of the game, which helps. But they were very rusty and made too many errors. But, you know, you'd be more concerned if they weren't creating opportunities and putting themselves in positions to create them. Against the Scarlets, I thought they played some really good rugby. I think they cut the Scarlets open a couple of times. But as I said, the power the Scarlets had in the front five was just too much for them. But I think that the brand of rugby that Dean Ryan is getting them playing, I think that's a big positive. Tompkins, you know, is a top end player, and he adds something that they haven't had for a long time behind the scrum. Hopefully, Jamie Roberts and Jonah Holmes will be available soon as well. So I think that their back line is looking a lot better than it has for 10 years. As I said, they've got a master tactician in Sam Davis, and their back row's as good as most in the Pro 14. But so those, you know, and they are a difficult team to beat. They had a very soft underbelly before Dean Ryan, and he's at the very least made them into a very tricky, sort of awkward team to play against. Mm. But you know, they're still at base camp, and they were coming from a very low point. So you've got to put everything into context. So, yeah, I think this is the first time for a long time you can see improvement, but they're not at the stage where they can realistically expect to go to a place like Ashton Gate and get a win. Stranger things have happened, of course, but as I said, I think Bristol are the strong favourites.
Yeah, I think undoubtedly they're heavy favourites. Base camp's an interesting analogy, actually. I think that it's, for me, this game, although I don't think there is much expectation on the Dragons to get the win, unless, you know, they have an absolute stormer and really catch really catch Bristol off guard. For me, this is the acid test in terms of how far they're able to improve. Because again, Dean Ryan's been quite open in saying that they've been targeting this game and, you know, have looked to change the lineups, experiment a little bit. You know, like we said, really those games were kind of pre-season friendlies or along those lines. So for me, this is the opportunity to see, can you compete with some of the top sides in Europe? Now, even, you know, this might sound pessimistic, but if 60 minutes gone, the Dragons are still in the game, I think that does show a real step in the right direction, because again, it's the kind of game that, you know, perhaps in the past you might get blown away. But, you know, oddly, Dragons have an extraordinarily good record at the quarterfinal stage in this tournament. You know, with wins against Gloucester and Cardiff in the past. So, you know, like you say, stranger things have happened. But for me, it's an acid test as to how far things are moving in the right direction. This is the game to kind of judge the season on, really.
Yeah, definitely. As you said, they have actually got a pretty good record of shocking teams in the quarterfinals. You know, they had that win up in King's home against Gloucester, I think it was about 5 years ago. So, you know, it's a cup game, isn't it? You know, it's cup rugby. It's on the day. You know, Bristol could get a red card in the first 10 minutes and then it's game on, isn't it? So anything can happen. But, you know, as I said, I just think, you know, Bristol have had a couple of heavy losses recently. I think the main reason for that is because they've rotated. Mm. But on their day, when they're full strength, they're a very formidable outfit. They've probably got one of the best coaches in European rugby anyway. And, if I was a betting man, I'd be putting my money on a home win.
You mentioned that a couple of times, the quality of the coaching from Pat Lamb, and I absolutely agree. That to me is why this is a Bristol side to be, you know, to be not just with regards to this game, but generally, this is why I think it is a real side to keep your eye on, because we all know about the quality of the signings that they've made, and you know, when you're able to bring in the likes of Sinclair and Randranda, it's a statement, and they've made other statement signings like it in the past as well. But the real thing is how they're able to gel and the work ethic and the culture and the tactics on the day. And that's the bit that I think, you know, arguably I'd say Pat Lamb is more important than any of those players.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, as you said, you know, Bristol, owned by Steve Lansdowne, you know, they're one of the wealthiest clubs in world rugby, let alone British rugby. And obviously they have signed marquee players like your Semi Randradra. As I said, you know, some would argue he's the best player in the world at the moment. Kyle Sinclair's, you know, in my opinion, if the Lions were playing next week, he'd be ahead of Furlong as a tight end. So they have signed these top-end, world-class players. But if you look at some of the other signings, right, had you heard of Callum Sheedy, really, before he'd signed for Bristol? Had you heard of Harry Randall, obviously, who's at Gloucester, but he wasn't getting much game time. Had you heard of Johan Lloyd as well? You know, this teenager that's come from nowhere, virtually. And, you know, suddenly he's in the 23 making a huge impact. So, you know, Pat Lamb is very good at spotting players who, you know, in the Championship or in the Welsh regions maybe, who haven't particularly made an impact elsewhere. I know Johan Lloyd's a kid. I mean, he would have come through anywhere, I think. He's that good. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is he picks players who aren't fashionable elsewhere and turns them into effective players. That's a sign of a good coach, isn't it? Somebody who improves players. You know, it's all well and good having superstar players, but if you look at what Pat Lamb did at Connacht, who had a very average playing roster, apart from maybe Bundy Archie and Robbie Henshaw. And I know the season they won the Pro 12 was a World Cup year, and, you know, they played some weakened teams and whatnot, but the job he did at Connacht was just defined what sort of coach he is. And as I said, Bristol have got superstar signings, but for Pat Lamb, you just get a sense that it's about culture first. And the fact that he signed some of these players who haven't, like Callum Sheedy, who maybe hadn't made it originally and had to go play in the English Championship, etc. Not specifically Sheedy, but other players as well. And have had to do the hard way. He wants that attitude in his squad. He doesn't just want somebody coming in on £700,000 a year or £1 million, allegedly, like, or just under £1 million, like Piatow, who has been a great signing. But he wants these other players as well. You know, it keeps them hungry. It keeps the culture strong in the squad. And And that's Pat Lam, I think. Yes, he wants these superstar signings, but everything's about building from the bottom up. And I think he is he's a nailed-on future international coach, isn't he?
Well, I think he absolutely is. The question as to where is going to be a fascinating one. I guess we'll have to wait until after the next World Cup cycle to find that out. But yeah, I mean, his CV to date is mighty impressive. But as you said, right at the top of the show, he'll be targeting silverware, and that will all start. The hunt for that all starts this Friday against the Dragons. So
there's pressure, isn't there? Because if you think about it, right, you know, Steve Lansdowne, how much money has he put into Bristol? He's put millions in. You know, I don't know. I only know what I've read, but Pia Tau allegedly on £1 million a year, roughly £1 million a year. You know, the Challenge Cup is a good opportunity to, you know, to win silver and to justify the money he's spending on that squad, isn't it? So, you know, let's make no bones about it. Lam is under pressure. He's going to have to win silver sooner or later. And, you know, Premiership, I can see him winning the Premiership in the future, but I think, you know, and maybe a few years away from that. So the Challenge Cup is a good opportunity to I know they've won the championship, but in terms of serious silver, it's a really good opportunity for them, I think.
Absolutely. Right, we're going to go on and look at the Scarlets and some of the other news stories from the rest of this week. We're going to do that in just one moment after this very, very quick break. Time then, Steph, to take a look at the Scarlets. And once again, they head over to France for a European quarterfinal. You mentioned in the first half that it's going to be a very, very tough task for the Dragons at Bristol. What then of the Scarlets' chances?
I think they have a significantly better chance of winning than the Dragons. I think Toulon are the favourites. You know, they may not quite be the team they were when they won 3 Heineken Cups on the bounce, but they're still one of the best teams in France. They certainly got one of the biggest packs in world rugby. But I honestly think the Scarlets have a very good chance to go in there and get a result, because if you look at the Scarlets have played Toulon on a number of occasions in Europe, mostly in the Champions Cup, but every single game has been very close. Mm. You know, there's not been more than 12 points or 10 points in the games, and every single game has followed an almost identical narrative. When Toulon keep it tight, when they play one-up rugby, you know, with shoving it up the jumper with a big ball carriers playing almost 10-man rugby, then the Scarlets struggle. But when the Scarlets are able to play the game on their terms, then Toulon struggle. And the results have all been quite tight. I mean, they played each other twice in the pool stage. Scarlets were very, very unlucky to lose out in France, and Tevita Rotuva had the moment of madness, a red card, yeah. And I think the Scarlets probably should have had about 3 penalties in the last 10 minutes when they were doing their best impression of Rope's Drift on the try line. So they were unlucky to lose that. Toulon deserved to win in Llanelli, but I think the weather beat the Scarlets as much as Toulon did. And I think if you look at this game, I'm not sure what the forecast is in France, of course, but you'd expect it to be, you know, it's in the south of France, it should be a pretty firm ground. So that'll suit the Scarlets, I think. And as I said, the Scarlets may have struggled a bit physically against them, but I think they've recruited really well in their pack. You know, Sam Lousy, he was there last year, but he's settled now. I think he's a high calibre signing. I think Sione Calmafoni as well. He's going to add something to them. Samson Lee being fully fit and scrummaging well is also a big boost. So I think the Scarlets pack, yeah, it's not quite as abrasive as Toulon's, but I think it's got enough about it to keep them in the game. And I honestly think, you know, this is a golden opportunity for them to go out there and get a result. As I said, Toulon are the favourites, but I think they stand a puncher's chance in this game.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and obviously we won't know the sides until later on in the week. But if you were in Delaney's shoes and you had to pick that side, what are you doing? Are you deliberately beefing up that pack, or are you still looking to keep a balance within there because you're going to want to keep ball in hand and play some quick rugby, especially if you're able to turn some ball over? What would you be thinking in terms of selection?
You don't want to get into an arm wrestle with Toulon. It's a balance, as you said. You don't want to get into an arm wrestle with them because their pack is big in the context of French packs. You know, they're big in comparison to the likes of Clermont, let alone some of the Pro 14 sides. But I think that, you know, you have to pick a big pack. Lewis Rawlings, one of my unsung heroes in Welsh rugby, outstanding in the derbies, but you know, for this game, you got to bring in Jake Ball, I think, and Sam Lousy. It's a big... I'm not sure at the moment what the situation is with Tevita or Tuva, who's like a monster, really, with his carrying and his physicality, because he's been stuck in Fiji. I think they were expecting him back for this game. He'd help. But I think Cal Mafoni's got to start, definite. They'll still have that Fetcher at open side. I think they picked McLeod over James Davis. And then, obviously, it'd probably be Kasim at blindside. So I think they've got to pick a big pack. I don't think that's going to change the way they play the game, but it's just going to give them a bit of a better chance to play that way, really. And one key point as well, in the game in Llanelli in January, their best players were Eben Estabeth, obviously one of the best locks in the world. He's out. And Bello as well was man of the match. He ran the show. He's out as well. Obviously, they got a ridiculous amount of strength and depth, but that's a boost to them as well. So I'm really looking forward to this game. I honestly think they, you know, I'm probably jinxing them now. They'll probably lose their 40 points, but they have got a realistic chance of winning. And, you know, the only problem is, are they undercooked coming into the game? I know they played the two derbies, but as I said, they were like glorified pre-season games, and they weren't the highest intensity going, whereas Toulon have played two top 14 games. I think it's going to be a very difficult ask, but it is a question that they can answer positively.
What about in the backs then for the Scarlets? What are the, which, yeah, I guess which players would you be looking to call upon? There's more options there in that back line now, and it's kind of much changed, I think, particularly in the centres with Hadley Parks going out and the likes of Johnny Williams coming in. Who would you be looking to form the basis of that back line?
Yeah, well, Jonathan Davis is back training, and they were hopeful that he'd be available for this game, so that'd be a huge boost. Whether it's wise, despite the quality of the player, whether it's wise to throw him straight in against Toulon, I mean, I don't know. I personally would have him involved. Liam Williams, not sure if he's going to be fit, but a back three of Halfpenny McNichol and Steph Evans is, you know, it's not too shabby, is it? You know, that's a back line that can score tries, and you know, with Halfpenny you've got one of the best goal kickers around. But an interesting selection will be outside half, because Patchell is expected to be fit. For me, Patchell gives the Scarlets an extra dimension in attack. He's the one that makes their back line tick more than anyone. Including Jonathan Davis, but Dan Jones, you know, was outstanding against the Dragons, playing really well. So that'll be an interesting call. Personally, I think you pick your best players, so I pick Foxy and Patchell. They got more. The Scarlets have got significantly more depth than the other regions, haven't they? That's why they've been better. So it's good to have those headaches. So in terms of this game, you know, Toulon are the favourites, and rightly so, but I do think the Scarlets can realistically win.
Yeah, I mean, just to build on that point you've said there, and I've mentioned this numerous times, that when it comes to recruitment, and you mentioned this with Bristol as well, right? Bristol are not just a side to be reckoned with purely because they signed Piatow and Randranda and Sinclair and players of that ilk. You said there that squad players, they bring in squad players, they make them better, and they push them for. And they end up pushing for first team, you know, for the first team jerseys. And that is the key to having a strong squad. Now, I think you're quite right. The Scarlets do have the most depth amongst the four Welsh regions. But that, yeah, and that has come down to the fact that, generally speaking, in the last 4 or 5 years, their recruitment has been really, in fact, probably a little bit longer. It's about picking up those rough diamonds of players who perhaps aren't top of the wish list of other players, but you can see the potential in there, and that's the thing that they've been able to do very, very well. And again, I think that means that when it comes to games like this, you then have those options and players pushing for contention, regardless of injury or availability.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's going back a number of years now, but Lewis Rawlings was playing for Cross Keys.
I know this kills me every time. Like every time he plays for the Scarlets, I just think he would be a legend in a Dragons shirt by now if someone within the setup at the time had taken a look at this guy at Cross Keys and gone, oh yeah, right, we need to get him training with the Dragons. And you know, it's been that one position that they needed someone of real grunt, and he just does it every time he's called upon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hitting it in the head. It's I don't know. I suppose it sums up the incompetency of the Dragons down the years, isn't it? Obviously, again, they're at together now, which is great. But yeah, Rawlings is one of these players. He's probably not an international player, but he's just a perfect Pro 14 player, isn't he? When you lose all your internationals and he's there week in, week out, hard tackler, massive work rate, good line of forward, really hard player, great attitude. Dragons have had a soft pack for a long time. He's exactly, you know, he wouldn't have cost that much, either, would he? Exactly the type of player they should have had. And he's there under their noses at Cross Keys, and then Gareth Jenkins comes, offers him a contract, and he goes to the Scarlets. It's just, baffling, isn't it, really?
It is baffling. And the thing that I find strange is that, and again, I think I mentioned this a few weeks ago, is that the Scarlets do have the strongest squad, yet every season they seem to pick up a couple of players from the Dragons who are deemed surplus to requirements and turn
Angus
them into
O'Brien as well.
Angus O'Brien, Phil Price, turn them into good squad players. You know, actually, I think Angus O'Brien, you know, he's got potential to be more than just a good squad player. Yeah. I think he's a really, you know, he's a really competent 10. But it's it does just baffle me that these players kind of to be deemed surplus to requirements at the side that has had the thinnest squad over the years and are able to go and better themselves. Obviously, Tyler Morgan's down there now. I think it's a slightly different scenario.
Yeah.
But it is a bit of a baffler.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of these players won't play for Wales. They might not be frontline players you want to play against your Toulons and your Leinsters and stuff. But in terms of the grind of the normal season, they're absolutely perfect, aren't they? You know, Angus O'Brien, not wanted at the Dragons by the sounds of it. You know, he had a bit of a setback early on with the Scarlets as he broke his leg, didn't he, against Racing. Mm. But yeah, he's been excellent for them. Lewis Rawlings has been one of the most important players, for a number of years. Phil Price has done reasonably well as well. They sign other players as well, like that Paul Asquith from Australia.
Asquith, Kennedy, these kind of players.
Yeah. Candy's Welsh qualified as well. So, the scouting system is significantly better than the other regions by the sounds of it, isn't it? So, proof's in the pudding, as I said. And, they may not be top-end sort of international players, but they certainly strengthen the Scarlet squad, haven't they? So, the recruitment's been really smart. And they've had more money than the other regions over the last few seasons. So they have been able to sign better frontline players as well, like Sam Lousy. You know, if he was, I know he's played for Tonga now, but if he wasn't a Kiwi, then he'd have won like 50 odd caps for another Tier 1 nation, probably, wouldn't he? He'd start for Wales, probably. So he's a top player. Blade Thompson's a top end player as well. Would have been an All Black, 100%. I've been told that if he hadn't had injuries. They have signed high caliber players as well, but certainly. Given the limited budgets of the Welsh regions, the Scarlets have been smarter in what they've done recruitment-wise than the rest.
Yeah, you've just got to make it. You know, if you're running the recruitment at the Welsh regions, you've got to think clever and make every pound count. And I think Scarlets have done that better than the other regions in recent times. To bring it back to this game, though, obviously you said there that the Scarlets have got a decent chance. I'm going to trouble you for a prediction, Steph. What do you think the result is going to be?
It's going to be really tight. Key for the Scarlets is staying in the game for an hour, for the first hour. If they can do that, then they get every chance and don't want to jinx it. But I'm going to go for a narrow Scarlets win.
There you have it. Right. Well, not too long. And like I say, as we said right at the top of the show, really looking forward to these ones. So, yeah, we'll of course be reviewing them on next week's show, so make sure you don't miss that. Time now to talk about the other big news story of the week, and that is the now, I think it's now officially called the Autumn Nations Cup, which will be taking place in November this year. So essentially a reworked version of the Autumn Internationals, featuring the Six Nations sides plus plus some others. And it's going to be shown primarily on Amazon Prime with a couple of games on Channel 4. Personally, I didn't think this was a massive surprise, Steph. I don't know about you.
No, it wasn't. Look, you know, the fact of the matter is rugby union's on its arse financially and it needs cash. And the fastest way to get cash is to put it behind a paywall. And, you know, let's be honest. I mean, you get a lot of people on social media saying that, and I appreciate times are hard for all, but, you know, they say that, oh, you know, I haven't got access to the games, this and that, I'm not paying this. But, you know, so many people have got Amazon these days, Amazon Prime, you know. It's just, it's widely available. You know, you can get it free for a month, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there is some sort of dealer.
You can, yeah, which would mean that in theory you can sign up and provide you remember to cancel, you could have the Autumn Cup for free.
Exactly, and I just think it's a no-brainer. They're getting more money. We're in troubled times, every union is on its backside. They're going to get more money than they normally would, which would go back then from a Welsh perspective, go back to the pro sides, then filter down into the grassroots rugby. So I think it's definitely the right thing to do.
Yeah, I generally speaking, you know, I think particularly when it comes to international games, because that is really your shop window for the sport. You know, I do like to see them on free-to-air television, but as you said there, we're dealing with, you know, we're kind of through the looking glass here. This isn't normal. This isn't normal rules of engagement. We're in a position where they've had to scramble to get this tournament off the ground to start with, and they need to make it as successful as possible. Still no idea whether there's going to be any crowds, looking increasingly like there's, you know, that's going to be hard to happen. Therefore, you've got to make it count from a broadcast perspective. Now, actually, it works really, really well for Amazon from a commercial point of view, because as well as them expanding into sport like they've done with Premier League football and with tennis, as a time of year, this is a perfect time for them because it's heading into Christmas.
Yeah.
So it's a perfect time to, you know, for them to try and recoup some of the money that they're spending on it. So all of those things make sense. Now, the other thing is that I think in Wales, it's undoubtedly it is a blow for fans. I think particularly if you're, you know, because BBC have covered it for years and years, and it is tricky. I think particularly if you're an older, you know, if you're an older fan or something like that, then it's a blow. But if I was in the union's position, I'd be doing the same. Now, I think the other thing to bear in mind is that this is replacing the Autumn Internationals. Now, England's games were already on Sky anyway. Mm. And yeah, the others flitted around a bit. I think Scotland was still on the BBC Ireland, Channel 4 have had for the last couple of years, but they have been on, you know, they played on BT a few years ago as well. So it has been a bit chopping and changing. The thing that's so important about this is the Autumn Internationals, you know, I used to absolutely love them going back 10, 15 years ago. Arguably, I enjoyed them more than the Six Nations because I just loved the opportunity of Wales, you know, being tested, you know, get the opportunity to beat in Australia or New Zealand. And even if it didn't happen, it was so exciting. There's been just overkill of playing against those nations. And that there is a need to create something meaningful in the autumn. We've seen it with football and the Nations League. And that has essentially replaced friendlies. And, you know, it just gives a degree of something on the line, particularly if it means, you know, it makes qualifying for a Euros easier. So I think they've done a good job, and rugby has quite rightly looked at that and said, well, we need to do something with regards to the autumn as well. So this, my understanding of this is that this has been done kind of as a joint deal, whereas normally England would sell their rights to whoever, Wales to whoever. This has been done as one. So, I mean, if anything is going to go behind a paywall, I would much rather it's Autumn than Six Nations. But with CVC, its increasing involvement with rugby. And you know, I still don't know whether I've seen the official announcement saying that they've bought a stake of the Six Nations, but you know, all
it's the word kept secret in rugby.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, all there. You know, no smoke without fire and all that. So, you know, if that is the case, I think you can expect to see more of it. I do think it's a worry for long term of rugby, but with this one in this scenario, I honestly don't think there's any option.
I agree. I'm just going back to one of the points you made about overkill. I agree 100% with that. You know, we seem to be playing Australia every year with the exact same
four times every year, and we lose in the last minute.
Yeah, we started to reverse our trend a bit, but yeah, no, I agree. It's like deja vu every time, but yeah, I agree with that. I mean, obviously, that your point will stand for the Six Nations as well, because we, from Wales' perspective, we've got a warm up against France. We play Scotland last year, Six Nations, and then we play a Six Nations with Fiji and Georgia. Great to see Georgia there, by the way. Mm. And we play the proper Six Nations, so there'll be overkill there as well, although it's got to be done for financial reasons. My preference when we've come out of this nightmare scenario, if we do, in terms of the pandemic, would be to see to the return of three test tours. And we get them when we go over there, but them coming over here, so Wales will play South Africa three tests. So Wales will play New Zealand three tests. Ireland play South Africa three tests. England, Australia three tests, et cetera, et cetera. We could do then as well. People are talking about how we can raise more cash for the regions. You could bring back midweek games. For example, the Scarlets, you know, Fitzpatrick has said on the record, but, you know, the Scarlets look like they're in negotiations with the All Blacks to play an anniversary game, whether it's New Zealand or the Maoris, I'm not sure, but to play some sort of game against them. That's going to be a sellout. They'll have TV money, et cetera, et cetera. You know, then they could play the Dragons or whatever, right? So that would help, wouldn't it, the domestic game, let's be honest. And I don't know about you, but you know, when it's a three-test tour, it's got a bit of spice about it, doesn't it? You know, something happens in the first test, somebody gets red-carded, or somebody, you know, Sonny Bill Williams has shown up by Jonathan Davis, then there's a bit of lip in the week, and then second test, you know, Sonny Bill wants to get his own back, et cetera, et cetera. Or the Welsh scrum got stuffed, so they're fired up, you know. Three-test tours have a little bit of an extra edge to them, in my opinion. So I'd like to see them reinstated in the long run. But in terms of Amazon Prime, as we've said, given the climate, I think it's a big risk in the long run to maybe go off free-to-air TV, especially the Six Nations. But at this moment in time, there's no choice.
No, there's not. And yeah, there's a lot of points you've raised in there. I mean, yeah, the overkill, I've said this before, you know, that's why I can't, as a fan, I'm kind of less than enthusiastic about this tournament, but it's got to happen. Just make it happen, and hopefully it's as successful as it can be, so that we're able to keep things going. In the long run, you know, I certainly like the idea of the regional or club sides playing against internationals. I think that again just appeals to the nostalgia in me. But you're right; it would certainly help in terms of getting fans down to regional grounds, definitely. And however, with three test series, again, I absolutely love them, but I think that if I was looking at it from the perspective of world rugby, I do think we've just got to be looking at how to get the tier two nations involved in a fair way. And I think if we end up playing New Zealand in a three-test series, or South Africa in a three-test series, it does then mean that there's less opportunity to play against those sides.
You could play three tests, and then World Rugby can make it compulsory to play one test against a tier two nation as well.
They could. And something like that has to happen regardless. You know, we do just need to realise the contribution that those nations make to the game. And do you know what? One of the best things I've ever seen in rugby was Japan beating South Africa in 2015. And the fact that then it was followed up, you know, with a fantastic World Cup campaign in 2019. You know, that if you'd have told me, even you go back to 2007, a Wales second 15 put nearly 60, 70 points on Japan in the World Cup. And yet you fast forward 8 years and 12 years and they're a serious force in world rugby. You do need to look at the way that there's a pathway through. Of course, it's up to individual nations to produce the right players and get the right coaches, but there does have to be an opportunity for them to dine at the top table. And that I think is really, really important. So in the long run, this autumn thing, it has to be cracked. And there has to be a good opportunity for developing nations to play against the big boys, and it also just has to be something that appeals to a casual fan. You know, it has to be this. You know, I think even, you know, obviously people like you and me are nuts for it, right? And we'll watch all kinds of rugby. But at the same time, you do have to just go, right, well, if we want more money in the game, we're going to have to attract an audience of someone who might watch 3-4 games of rugby every year, and having a meaningful autumn competition, whether it's a test series or it's some kind of competition, without watering down the World Cup. That is the nut that's there to be cracked. World rugby and the individual nations and the individual unions go and solve it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in terms of the emerging nations, if we use our term over tier two nations, I think, yeah, there is a World Rugby should be making, almost forcing the tier one nations to play them. I mean, obviously the tier one nations have got to get some sort of financial benefit out of it, but I still think, you know, in normal times, if Wales played Georgia on Friday night, for example, they'd probably get 50,000. If not more, you know, cheaper tickets in the stadium, etc. So, yeah, I you know, you said Japan beating South Africa is one of the best things you've ever seen in rugby. One of the best things I've ever seen in sport.
Agreed.
It was just phenomenal. And to see the way they've kicked on, I don't count them as a tier two nation anymore.
No, I don't. Absolutely not.
Tier one. And they got the economy as well to sustain a professional domestic league as well. So I think they're moving forward quite fast now. So, yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's going to be a priority of World Rugby to ensure the tier two nations like Georgia have some sort of route to the top. I'm not saying throw them in the Six Nations because I think that's a bit too far, but I think they should at least have, I don't know, a two-legged playoff even against the team against a wooden spoon. Make it as difficult as possible for them to qualify so that if they actually do, then they deserve it. But, you know, at least give them a glimmer of hope and, you know, for the tier one nations to at least have to play a tier two nation twice a season, for example. So I think that's probably the way forward.
Yeah, and you're right. That it does, you know, it has to work commercially as well. That's the fundamentals of it. It can't just, you know, it can't just be a nice theory in practice. And that's where I think that, you know, like you say, there, Wales feed you on a Friday night. We'd probably still do 50,000, admittedly, with reduced ticket prices and stuff and getting kids down and stuff like that. But Wales playing Georgia in a, you know, in a meaningful group game of some kind of competition that you actually want to win, and having, you know, I'm imagining scenarios here, but let's say it's three teams in a pool and we've already lost to South Africa on the first game, or we drew with them or something, and there's something on the line there, then that starts to become something that, you know, maybe 60,000-70,000 will turn up for. So it is meaningful, is the word I keep coming back to. That is what we kind of have to create with the autumn. And I don't think this autumn is it. I might change my mind if Wales beat England and Ireland, and, you know, they're suddenly kind of top of the pool. But
what you got to take into consideration as well, mind. It was a front story of the rugby paper today by Peter Jackson, and he made an excellent point. He said, in terms of the world rankings, the World Cup draw has been pushed back to December. Mm-hmm. Wales, say they had a bad tournament, they could be in the third tier, and they could end up with England and South Africa in their pool. So, you know, they are a bit more meaningful maybe than people are making out. So,
you're absolutely right from a... yeah, you know, if you're Wayne, and if you're Wayne Pitt, like you want to start getting some wins under your belt as well, and to relieve some of that pressure. So there is meaning in that regard. I think meaningful, you know, when I use that expression, it's more with regards to selling it in to people, you know, to getting people excited, and to for there being something genuinely on the line, and being able to explain it in a way that, I don't know, just appeals to as many people as possible. And that's the nut that the eggheads have got to crack over the, I suppose over the next year, really, presumably with this autumn Nations Cup kind of having a full identity and stuff. And crucially, with them having been able to monetize it with Amazon Prime, I think a version of it will come back next year, but quite what it looks like, I think that's that probably remains to be seen.
Yeah, interesting times as well, obviously, with CBC coming on board. I think we're going to have a lot of change at both domestic and international level over the next 3 or 4 years. So I suppose it's just watch your space, isn't it, really? But I just like to see the status quo shaken up a little bit, you know? Because with rugby, it is like the same old, same old. Yeah, Six Nations is a great competition, but we're resting on our laurels a little bit as well, aren't we? You know, we've got Six Nations, so it's fine. Well, no, let's look to make it better, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, what you might find is you have the Six Nations and it's fine with a, you know, in the short term, and you sell those rights to Sky or Amazon or whoever it is, and CVC make a killing. If they then exit the sport and you end up, you know, like Formula One has done to a certain degree, with an aging fan base and a much lower profile, what then becomes of the Six Nations? You know, you've killed the cash cow. What next? And that's the thing that I'm much more interested in, how they can build a, you know, you're absolutely right, shake up the status quo and build some tournaments and evolve them and do it in a way that means that we end up with better quality rugby, not players just flogged to death because they've got to play 13 tests every year. And, you know, finding that balancing act is going to be tricky, but it certainly can't carry on the way it has done.
Absolutely not. And I just think as well, the club game or the domestic game has been under commercialized as well, hasn't it? And that's the big hope of CVC. That, yeah, it's a big risk, but you know, we need a global season. You know, international rugby ruins a club game, really, doesn't it? I know international should always be a pinnacle. I probably make this point every time I'm on this podcast, but that needs to change. You know, nailed on that. You know, the South African Super Rugby teams are coming into the Pro 14. I've spoken to people in the know, and they're pretty confident that there'll be a British and Irish League in 2025 when the TV deal ends, and that'll lead to the South African teams coming in the Pro 14 is perhaps CVC's way to push the Springboks into the Six Nations. Whether you agree with that, I don't know, but you know, they obviously want the South African market. So, but yeah, I just think, you know, rugby hasn't worked professionally, really. It's worked to a certain extent, but it's not reached its potential. And it got to a certain level where it was reasonably good. And it's gone backwards, isn't it, over the last 5 years? Yeah. Across the board, isn't it, really? Especially at club level. Like, they ruined the Heineken Cup, didn't they?
Absolutely ruined
it. You know, I think we said before, and we on this podcast, I think a month ago, whatever it was, I think you made that point. And I just think we're at a crossroads now, aren't we? And I just think we need to try things. So I just think it's going to be fascinating. You know, why waste a good crisis, you know?
Well, that's it, isn't it? That is the, you know, I think you're absolutely right with that, but more and more I get the feeling that this crisis is being a bit wasted. But I do think that the thing is here is that CVC are the, you know, I can't think of an analogy because I'm far too tired, Steph, I'm afraid. But they are the ones who have the opportunity to shake these things up, right? And that's for good and for bad. They're going to be commercially driven, right? So whatever they do is going to be, to line their own pockets. However, that might just mean that they're able to crack enough skulls to get some proper change at the top of the game, and with their fingers in the pies of Premiership Rugby, Six Nations, Pro 14. There's also rumours that they're willing to invest or are trying to outbid another investment company in the Trans Tasman competition. that's scheduled for, I think, 2022, maybe. I think next season might be the same as this season. So that, again, you know, when you start to have that much for stake in the global game, you've got the opportunity to call the shots, because once those clubs and unions have taken your money, you know, CVC will want their pound of flesh. And I hope that the people who are making the decision there have the sense to say, right, we're not just going to flog the players to death. We're going to create much better quality tournaments. And like you said there, don't have international and club rugby overlapping, because it dilutes the quality. Dilutes the quality, it dilutes the interest, dilutes the interest, it dilutes the money. So that's my hope, is that while we're kind of dancing with the devil a little bit here,
yeah,
there is the opportunity to get things done.
And another thing, in terms of international rugby, right, I think there's far too much emphasis on World Cups. The World Cup should always be the pinnacle.
Mm.
But I remember, I think it was a month or two back, I was reading an interview with Rory Best, and he was talking about Ireland's failed World Cup campaigns. And he was like, lead up to 2007, he was like, everybody was like, oh, everything's about the World Cup, everything's about the World Cup. And then they sort of peaked before the World Cup, and then they flopped, you know, out in the pool stage, lost to France and Argentina. So there's a bit too much emphasis. Oh, we're building towards, you know, you're coaches all the time. You know, they're putting young players out, you know, not the strongest teams, and they say, oh, you know, we're building towards the World Cup. You know, you've lost. How disappointed are you? Oh, no, I'm positive. You know, we're building towards the World Cup. And I'm like, yeah, fine, build towards the World Cup. But, you know, if you bought a ticket for a game, do you get what I mean?
Oh, I do, yeah.
The balance isn't right. The balance isn't right between building for the future. It's an excuse, isn't it? And building towards the World Cup.
Steph, you'll have been sat in the Millennium Stadium the same as I have on a piss miserable November day at, you know, at 5:30, and then the trains are all cancelled on the way home, and you've just watched the side get, you know, you watch the Welsh national side get, you know, Australia beat you by 20 points or South Africa beat you by 20 points, and you've paid 50-60 quid for the privilege of it. Well, that, you know, that's and you're right, you know, I'm sure Warren Gatland's sides did learn things about that, about those games, and I probably don't blame him for making those decisions, but you're right, there has to come a point where you can't just mess around in international games because you're building towards the World Cup. And again, that's, you know, that might well be where there's opportunities with these, you know, with whatever we're calling them, you know, the kind of the tour games or opportunities like that. You know, it does give you a bit more of an opportunity, but that's only going to happen if we stop flogging the players to death, because they're playing too much rugby as it is. And so, yeah, for me, it's about reducing the number of fixtures and getting some good tournaments across the global season. And, you know, I tell you what, it looks interesting, that Trans-Tasman competition. That really does, because for me, Super Rugby, it blew up, and it went too big. It became too complicated. And again, the quality was diluted. And actually, I think that Australia, New Zealand plus a Japanese side and a Pacific Nations side of some sorts, that feels like the kind of thing that would get people in those countries excited about it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, competitions where there's, I know the Six Nations is one, obviously, but the autumn, as we said, you know, the autumn is, some of the games are a bit, not meaningless, but there's no sort of jeopardy. There's no prize at the end of it. Playing the All Blacks is a bit different.
It is, yeah.
You need some sort of competition. Like football, soccer had a similar problem, didn't they? Like outside of the World Cup and the European qualifiers, the games were like, the friendlies were a waste of time, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Dead rubbers. And rugby, test matches in rugby, I've got a bit more meaning maybe than the friendlies in football do. But it's a similar sort of scenario though, isn't it, really?
They're not what they once were, you know, and I think that's just because of the sheer number of them. And you think back to, you know, you think back to rugby kind of pre-2004 kind of thing, and you would have, you know, maybe South Africa would come over and tour Wales and play a number of club games, and then you might get one or two tests against the Welsh national side. And there's so much riding on it that you know, that's kind of what it all builds towards. But yeah, when you play 12 tests a season, it's it doesn't have the same pull, and therefore by definition it starts to creep into that friendly territory.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think CV, as we said, you know, CVC aren't in this for the goodness of, you know, of the game. They want their pound of flesh. But obviously the positive for us, hopefully, is the way they're going to get their pound of flesh is by making the game better. So I think we will see more meaningful competitions. The you know, like the Nations Cup, etc. In football, it's never going to be as important as the Euros or the, you know, the World Cup, obviously, and it'll be the same in rugby. But it is something, isn't it? You know, it's a
massive improvement.
Yeah, and hopefully we'd see the same in rugby. But the only, again, you know, we can't be. There's no such thing as nirvana, really, is it? You know, it's because there's so many countries playing football, it doesn't matter. But because there's so little playing top level rugby, does it devalue the World Cup? That's the question. It's about the balance, isn't it?
100%. Yeah, absolutely agree. Well, it's definitely
the answers, but we will see change.
Yeah, I think we will see change. And like you said earlier, watch this space, or at the very least, listen to it here on the Attacking Scrum. Steph, been great to chat to you. Enjoy the games next week, and I'm sure we'll chat very, very soon. And to all you listeners, thanks for listening, and we will be back to chat rugby with you next week. Thanks. Podcast Network.